And I'm in studio today on the 10th of March with Calvin Young. He is one of the 13 Democratic candidates for the office of mayor of Baltimore. He's 28 years old, born and raised here in Baltimore, currently lives in Hamilton. He has no political public office experience at the moment. He is a former White House aide at the National Economic Council. He holds an MBA from Harvard University and a BS in engineering from New York University. Calvin Young, welcome.
How are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks.
Thanks.
So let me ask you two questions. The first is, why do you want to be the mayor? The second is, why should the voters want you to be the mayor? But let's start with you. What is appealing to you about this job?
Well, I'm looking for something that really gives me the opportunity to make strong impact. We'll go through my background, but you know, I've been blessed in a lot of ways. I've gained a lot of skills. I've managed multi-million-dollar budgets. I've managed large amounts of people. I've inspired young people. I've done all of these things in life. And what I see, especially after the death of Freddie Gray, is that somebody like me who's born and raised here can really come and make a great difference. But running for mayor wasn't the original thing for me. It was originally just to go and find out what's the best way for me to do something. But I noticed everybody's at the table for change and for making the city a better place. We're just very pessimistic about the existing cadre of leaders that we have. And I see myself as being somebody that could unite the city, that we can all be proud of, and hopefully somebody who can get the job done well if elected.
We should note that you were perhaps the very first person to declare for mayor.
That's right.
You declared a long time
ago. I was the first person who had not held the office before to run for mayor. And that's because I don't need polls and all these other things to tell me if I should run. It was because it was the right thing to do. And, you know, that's the type of leader we need in Baltimore right now. Somebody who's willing to stick to their guns and do something right because of conviction.
And refresh my memory, I think you declared for mayor even before Mayor Rawlings-Blake decided she was not going to seek re-election.
That's absolutely right. I declared August 17th, and that was the only two people were Stephanie Rawlings-Blake and Sheila Dixon. And I just said to myself, it can't be that. We can do better. And, you know, I'm better than that for our city. And I also know that if there's anybody who's young who can galvanize, you know, the young African-American male or female who's struggling in Baltimore and really be somebody they can believe in, I felt like it would be me. And I've got the background to be able to, you know, pull together a campaign and make it happen. So I decided to walk this journey at that point. It's been exciting ever since.
Yeah, it certainly has been. You've certainly been out in front of the public. You've been at many, many forums. I mean, dozens and dozens of them. You've probably lost count of them, but I would guess 30, 40, something like that.
At least 30. Definitely probably around 40.
Yeah. So the voters then, when they look at you, they say, well, here's this very bright guy. Obviously, he's, you know, got an engineering degree. He went to Harvard Business School. He's, very smart and accomplished in his business career, but he's never been in government before. He's never held political office. You're not the only candidate in the race making a virtue of that. There are others who are saying, you know, we don't need politicians anymore. We need people with different kinds of backgrounds. But for people who do have a concern about that, how do you answer the folks that say, you know, he's never held any political office. Why should he hold the top job in the city of Baltimore?
Well, you know, just like you said, everybody knows that it's a virtue right at this moment, given the context of the city, to not have held public office before, to come in with a fresh set of eyes. In the manufacturing floor, we used to call that, you know, shiny eyes. Somebody who can walk in and see things that everybody else couldn't see because we've been stuck in the minutia the entire time. So I look forward to, if elected mayor, being a person that could come in, see the skeletons that were there, but everyone's been walking past, and say, hey, we can clean that up. We can do something better here. So that's what I tell people who think that, you know, holding public office is a prerequisite to being a mayor. At the end of the day, what we need is a strong leader, somebody who can get the job done well. And I can do that. It doesn't take having, you know, political office to be able to do that. If anything, at this point, holding political office prior to now really ties you to the bureaucracy that's made our city such a difficult place. And I look forward to being able to change that.
Tell us about your business experience and perhaps your experience in the White House that contributes and informs the way you manage people and the way you approach problems.
So I started my career at Sikorsky Aircraft, which is a helicopter company, the manufacturer of the Black Hawk helicopter, working on aircraft health management. After that, I shifted into operations, and that's really where I got a lot of my management experience. I worked as a supplier quality engineer for one of the subsidiaries of United Technologies. And actually, I was in a rotational program, so they gave me a number of different assignments, the second being a commodity manager where I managed $500 million worth of commodity spend. And then the final assignment was you know, out in Arkansas as a manufacturing supervisor on a shop floor, working to repair jet engine parts. You know, and I had my own team of folks that worked directly for me. All of them were over twice my age. And I was responsible for hirings, firings, raises, performance evaluations. I'm also a former national chair of the National Society of Black Engineers, which is a multi-million-dollar, multinational organization. We have a world headquarters facility in Alexandria, Virginia, 30 paid staff, 30,000 members across the world. And I was the person in charge of all of this, helping to excite and expose young people to STEM, to help engineers get jobs and create jobs. It was an exciting experience. So all of these things, and then also my time at the White House, where I focused on small business policy and really the strong impact that a small business has on the economy, especially in places like Baltimore, where we don't have a lot of large companies that hire a lot of people. I think all of these gives me a set of skills that helps us to be able to move the city forward if I'm elected. Because A, I know how to manage resources. I know how to do audits. I know how to do all those things. I know how to manage people and motivate people and change culture. But I also know how to find challenges that we have and identify a path forward because of my background in operations so that we can fix the things that need to be fixed. And then I think what also makes me exciting, being a young person, being a millennial who's, you know, really heavy into the tech scene, and in small business, with a lot of small business experience, it gives me the opportunity to also, you know, project a vision out of what Baltimore can be as far as, you know, creating new jobs, creating businesses, you know, creating an ecosystem where, you know, our education in Baltimore City Public Schools prepares a student to go to college, to study engineering, to be an artist, to study math, and eventually, you know, be a brilliant person in the world. These things are possible in Baltimore. It's not possible under the current leadership. It's not possible if we choose someone who's been in public office, but it is possible if we're bold in our decision-making about who's going to be the next mayor.
Talk a little bit more about your experience at the White House. You worked for the White House National Economic Council. You were an aide in that office. What was your purview? What was your assignment? Did you make recommendations to the president? Did you make recommendations to Congress for legislation? What kind of work were you doing?
So the vast majority of my work was to make recommendations to the assistance to the president, who would then deliver to the president. I should also say that I did write some memos that would eventually end up in the president's hand as well. But specifically, some of the big things that I worked on, we worked on a large report called Making in America, and it spoke about manufacturing, the new maker movement, the creation of maker spaces in cities around the country, and really trying to encourage the municipalities around the country to invest in technology, to invest in these types of incubators, such that young people and tech entrepreneurs have an opportunity to grow and thrive and build things. And we're talking about new technologies like additive manufacturing technologies like 3D printing, like laser cutting, and bringing these to cities because it's going to be the new wave of manufacturing that helps bring jobs back from overseas to the United States because it's going to be lower cost. So that was a section of my work. Another section of my work, which is probably the largest section, was around small business policy. We did a lot of work, looking at what things work as far as policies that could help entrepreneurs and small businesses. One of the things I'm really proud of is a program called Supplier Pay that I worked on. And Supplier Pay is a public-private partnership between the White House and Fortune 500 companies, where the companies decide to support their small businesses by either one, providing a lower cost of capital alternative to them just going to a bank and getting a loan, or providing their credit rating to their small business supplier such that they could get loans at lower rates. That way the small business can save money. That money can then be used to eventually make investments and hire people. And again, if two-thirds of all new net job growth come from small businesses, over 50% of people who are hired by small businesses. For the White House, we were really interested in what types of things could help create jobs, and we thought that this was a great way to do it. And I'm happy to say that when we launched, we had about 26 of the Fortune 500 had signed up. Since then, I know that number has at least doubled, we've done a lot of great work.
Talk about then what the capacity of the mayor can be to create jobs in the city of Baltimore. As you say, small businesses are the ones that, you know, create most of the jobs. But if you're in the mayor's office, mm-hmm. what is it that you can do to create a climate or to create a situation where more small businesses are making more offers to people for employment?
This is a great question. There's so many things I have to say on this. I'll try to make it quick. Number one, we got to stop nickel and diming. So the quick things that we can do is we can look at, you know, policies that we have to eliminate costs for small businesses. Number two, public-private partnerships, where we create public works, you know, projects to help give jobs to people who could eventually create wealth amongst themselves, and then eventually, you know, be job creators themselves and start businesses. The two biggest challenges that we have when it comes to creating small businesses is access to capital and the wraparound resources. Access to capital, the city can help by creating microfinancing loans to entrepreneurs, especially in our toughest communities, so that they can create jobs. And the business may fail, and most businesses are going to fail, but it's not about the business, it's about the entrepreneur and investing in them so that they start again, fail, start again, and eventually do something that works. But then also when it comes to incubators, we have a lot of abandoned buildings in the city. Let's refurbish some of them and create incubator spaces where we're literally giving, you know, artists and entrepreneurs free space such that they can be creative, and they can do it together. We cluster them together so that they can, you know, work together. They can meet other entrepreneurs. They can get resources from the city easily. They can get resources from investors. And we position them in some of the toughest neighborhoods, and we actively seek out people in those neighborhoods who can be investors. You know, there's a statistic that says that, you know, as you increase black entrepreneurship specifically in the toughest neighborhoods, we also see youth and violent crime go down in those neighborhoods. So imagine in a place like Baltimore where 90% of people who are shot in the street are young African-American men. We increase investments into entrepreneurs and we see that youth violent crime go down. And that happens because we have more people who are willing to invest in the neighborhoods, more people who are willing to hire from the neighborhoods, and overall an economy that works because small businesses invest and the dollar can continue to cycle within the city.
Speaking of public safety, it's one of the pillars of your platform, public safety along with education and the economy. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts on public safety? You know, there's a report just out by the No Boundaries Coalition about the relationship between people in Penn North in that 21217 zip code and the police. Some very harsh things to say about the way the police are interacting with citizens. You've given some thought to that.
So my grandma lives in the 21217. So I understand very clearly exactly the challenges because I'm over there all the time. There are a couple things that we can do. Number one, there are things that we can do that can make the city a safer place and don't affect the interaction. So what do I mean? There are other cities like New York, Washington, Chicago, Oakland, who have gun detection technologies across their city such that anytime a gunshot goes off, there's a recording of it and a GPS location that's given to first responders and the police officers. So every time a gunshot goes off, there's a police officer showing up. And what they've seen is that it actually changes the behavior of those who carry guns. They've seen 49% reductions in gun incidences in these cities. In Baltimore, we said it costs too much, and that's the reason we weren't willing to bring this technology to Baltimore a year ago. And it only actually cost $300,000, and it was going to be paid for by a state grant. So I don't understand why we didn't make that decision. But, man, we could have saved a lot of lives. And it also changes the interaction between the police officer and the community, because now when a gunshot goes off, the police officers aren't talking to people in the community and you know, knocking on your door and trying to figure out what happened. But instead, they're showing up faster, and they're asking you, does somebody need to talk to a detective? Are you guys okay? What's going on? So the community and police relationship has also seen improvements in these cities. But I also think that there's a lot of things with regards to training that we have to do better. You know, when we train police officers, we train them on how to deal with suspects, victims, informants, witnesses. But we don't train them on how to deal with ordinary, everyday citizens. And if you're a young black man, you know, and you're 19 years old, walking Penn North, you're not being treated like a normal citizen. You're being treated like a suspect. That's what the evidence shows. So I think when I spoke to Commissioner Davis, he said that a lot of police officers are introverted when it comes to dealing with ordinary citizens. If we can teach them how to be extroverted to create interactions with the citizenship that are more positive, then I think that can be the long-term critical piece that really helps to change culture in the city with regards to our relationship with the police.
one of your proposals in education is to do targeted summer programming to, I guess, you know, keep kids in a education mode 12 months a year, not just 9 months a year. What do you mean by that? What form does that take?
Well, when I was national chair of the National Society of Black Engineers, we used to run summer engineering experience for kids camps. And when I was, during my term as chair, we had 12 camps in 11 different cities around the country. And what we saw was that you would have kids who had no experience into science, technology, engineering, and math, third through fifth graders. And by the time they finished the programs, you got a whole 300 kids talking about they want to be engineers. And now their mind has changed. Now they're interested in math. They're interested in science. They're interested in, you know, all these things that normally are not cool. So I think that we can change the paradigm in Baltimore City education by doing that. But it's more than just summer programs. You know, I talk about universal pre-kindergarten, algebra by 7th grade, calculus by 11th, because I want to prepare kids to go to college. They may decide not to go, but you're going to, when you get your high school diploma, if you decide to go, you've been prepared by Baltimore City Public Schools to go there. And that right now is not the case. Matter of fact, the National Action Council for Minorities in Engineering had a study a couple years ago that showed that only 4% of minority students in this country are prepared to go into engineering coming out of high school. I want Baltimore to be at the forefront of changing that dynamic. And recently, the city council approved a mayor override such that 3% of the budget goes towards youth programs. Here's what I'm thinking. That equates to about $30 million. When we used to run these camps, it cost about $250,000 to $300,000 to do each for 300 kids. If I could take a third of that, $10 million, then and invest that into summer programs that teach kids science, technology, engineering, math, with a concentration in the arts as well incorporated, I can imagine where we're preparing 10,000 kids a year out of Baltimore City Public Schools with this $10 million to be going into science and tech to be educated and ready to go to college. It's something that's been proven to work and can be done here in Baltimore.
Let's talk a little bit about the sort of practical logistics of politics. You're in a very crowded field, 13 candidates. There's polls out saying that some of the candidates, you and four or five others, are not really registering in the polls at the moment. What do you see as your path to winning this nomination? How do you have the resources to move forward? And if you do have those resources, what would you spend it on to get your message out to voters?
So I don't think money is going to win this election, but I do think getting your message out in front of folks will win this election. And what I want to do is make sure that I'm at the table when a voter is looking at everybody's pamphlets and deciding who they're going to vote for. My pamphlet is right there. So when I fundraise, I don't need to fundraise $600,000 or $1 million like some of these other folks. It's really got a lot to do with the fact that my message is strong. And so I understand that, you know, I don't have big developers and wealthy families who everybody in the family is giving me $6,000 to fundraise for my campaign. You know, we've had 550 donations and more from people who are giving $100, $200, $300 to my campaign. And there's no other candidate that, quote unquote, isn't registering the polls that can say that. January 3rd, 20th, when we filed our filings, we had $42,000 in the bank, or raised, not in the bank, but raised. And we've done a significant amount since then. I'm excited about the idea that I'm going to be able to make sure that we have a strong mailer campaign that gets out to folks. We're going to be aggressively delivering on social media. We have already. And again, a lot of these polls are polling people who are over 50 and over 65. Young people, in my opinion, are going to vote in this election, and they're not being registered in the polls. And that's why you see people like me who appeal to the new generation not registering the polls. So I'm okay. We're going to run this all the way to the end, and I think we're going to do something special and surprise a lot of people. And if elected, we're going to do a lot of great work.
Calvin Young is 28 years old. He is a Baltimore born and raised native, currently living in Hamilton. He is seeking his first political office, that of mayor of Baltimore. He's one of 13 candidates on the Democratic ticket in the primary on April 26th. Mr. Young, thank you for your time.
I appreciate you too. Thank you.